Authors, writers, dreamers, all. Each day is an invitation to accept the call. I'm Brooke Warner from She Writes.
And I'm Grant Faulkner from NaNoWriMo. You're listening to Right Minded, weekly inspiration for writers.
So it's almost August, Grant. You know what that means?
I think it means that my kid's school year is coming up and it's my son's senior year and I probably forgot to turn in some crucial paperwork or pay for class photos or something like that. Does it mean something else to you?
Yes, it means that I am about to go on vacation.
Woohoo, good for you. Where are you going?
Amman, Jordan, and I leave next week. I know.
Wow. So we could have recorded an episode today.
Yeah, but I'm packing.
Okay, so you're leaving, I guess you're leaving me alone to talk to my alter ego?
Well, we could do that, but I also have a plan so we don't leave listeners hanging. We've had all these amazing guests over the course of the past year, and I looked at the growth in our listenership and thought perhaps a lot of these people had missed out on some of those early interviews. So what if we resurface some of our favorites?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds better, much better than me talking to myself. But just so our listeners know, I'm happy to do a show of me talking to myself at some point. Yeah, we've got a lot of good early episodes to choose from. So I think it's a great idea that we, choose a few and do a few weeks of mashups. And then we'll be back with some changes on the show starting on August 19th. So this week, how about if we treat you to Mignon Fogarty, a.k.a. Grammar Girl, and Jane Friedman, two super smart women who touch upon the process and business side of writing. Grammar Girl was actually our very first guest.
I know. How crazy is that? This year has flown by, and I want to give a huge and warm thank you to our listeners, and we invite you to enjoy these truncated interviews. And if you like what you hear, scroll down in your right-minded feed and listen to the full original episode.
Here goes, starting with the famous Grammar Girl. So I am very curious. Your persona of Grammar Girl is huge on the internet. How did you become Grammar Girl?
Right. Well, gosh, now almost 12 years ago, I was working as a professional freelance writer and editor. And I have a degree in English, but I realized they hadn't taught me all the little nitpicky rules I needed to know to be a professional writer and editor. So every day I was looking up rules in the Chicago Manual of Style, in the AP Style Book, and coming up with memory tricks to help me remember the rules. And at the same time, I started hearing about podcasting, and I love technology. And so I wanted to try this new thing called podcasting. And it just sort of seemed like it made sense to do a short, quick, and dirty tip about writing and the rules that I was already looking up anyway. And I had dabbled with a science podcast before that and was sort of looking for something a little different to do and thought, I'll just record these writing tips I'm looking up for myself, just a weekly quick and dirty tip. And quick and dirty, it comes from when I was growing up in Seattle, my mom would say, oh, let's just do a quick and dirty job on these dishes, or let's just do a quick and dirty job and get the big weeds out of the garden, you know. And so to me, quick and dirty tips is, you know, just the basics of what you need to know. The like, let's just get the job done so you can do what you need to do. And, you know, it's scripted. It's one tip every podcast, or it was in the beginning. It's longer now, but now it's usually two or three segments. But that's how it really started. I was looking up these tips for myself. I wanted to do more podcasting, and it just came together. And much to my surprise, within 6 weeks of launching, it was number 2 at iTunes, and it just rocketed up the charts. And it really, from what I can tell, it was all word of mouth. I didn't really do anything to promote it at the time. So I just was in the right place at the right time with information people wanted. And, you know, once it started doing well, then I started working really hard to make it a business.
Well, I love that, a quick and dirty lifestyle, essentially, which is what I lead. everything has to be quick and dirty, including writing. I'm curious, since you've done so many podcasts now and written so many books on grammar, do you just know it all at this point?
No. In fact, I will sometimes I'll Google, you know, tip and my own page will come up. And that always makes me laugh. You know, I do. I look things up, you know, in my own notes, in my own books, and on my own website. There are so many rules. You know, one of my favorite reference books is Garner's Modern English Usage, and it's more than 900 pages long. Like, no, who can remember all that? Nobody can remember all that. You just need to know where you can look up things that you need to know.
That is insane, actually. And it reminds me of not only Chicago Manual of Style, which you brought up, but there's AP style, and there's lots of different debates going on about grammar. And then one of the things, because I'm a book editor as well, is I know Chicago is constantly updating itself, and then its rules are different from one edition to the next. And so what is your position on the rules of grammar, and how do you even begin to scratch the surface of the rules changing or advise people on things that can sometimes, in fact, be subjective or changing from edition to edition?
Right. I know sometimes listeners and readers get frustrated with me because I won't give them one answer all the time. You know, and that's what people want. They want the one answer. They just want to know. But sometimes it's different in Chicago and AP. You know, I mean, a really common example is whether you put an apostrophe S after a word that ends with S. So is it Kansas's statute with an apostrophe S at the end, or is it Kansas's statute with just an apostrophe after Kansas? Well, it depends on which style guide you follow. So, you know, I often tell people that they need to, especially a professional writer, you need to know which style guide the publication you're writing for prefers. You know, and if you're an editor for a publication, you need to have a style guide for your writers so they know what rules to use. So, you know, sometimes it changes. You know, I love the American Copy Editor, the ACES meeting, the American Copy Editor Society annual meeting. One of the highlights of the meeting is when the AP style book editors announce the updates to the style guide for the year. You know, and so things change every year for AP. And, you know, if you're a professional, you just have to stay on top of that. You have to know what the new rules are and incorporate them into your workflow.
I remember one time, maybe you can tell me if this is a true memory, because when I was working at Seal Press, whichever version of Chicago we were working on at the time, it was what you were saying, the apostrophe S was the rule, and the only exception was Jesus.
Right. And yes, there was Jesus and Moses, and I think maybe Zeus. It was, yeah. So there were some, I think they called them classical names, exceptions.
I just imagine the guys sitting around the table being like, but not for Jesus and not for Moses.
Right. Because I remember making a joke that like Jesus got dissed because they took away his S or something like that. But yeah, and I can't remember. I think maybe they've changed that now, but you know, I would have to look it up. I don't know off the top of my head, but I vaguely remember that rule went away and now it's more consistent.
When I learned grammar, it just seemed like these rules were written in stone, there was no interpretation involved or no kind of going beyond the rules. And I know you did a TED Talk on how language changes and how we essentially vote for word, you know, word changes through our usage. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how this is, nothing is truly written in stone, I guess?
Right. Well, one thing linguists sometimes give me a hard time about is that a lot of what I talk about isn't grammar. So, you know, I'm grammar girl because people think it's grammar. That's what they look for when they're searching. But it's style, it's usage, you know, it's punctuation. It's not all grammar. In fact, most of what I do isn't grammar, but it's what people think of as grammar. And that's actually an example of language changing, because grammar means something specific in the like language scholar world. But to the general public, grammar means something completely different. Grammar means, you know, the entire cloud of all the language rules that you have to know. So in a way, that's a good example of how words can change their meaning. I mean, the examples I love, if you go back 100 or 200 years and look at the things people considered wrong back then, you start feeling really ridiculous about the things that you think are wrong today, because you know in another 100 or 200 years, people are going to look back and say, what? They thought that was wrong? So, you know, an example is like, it used to be wrong to call curtains drapes.
Hmm.
Like, that was an outrage.
Right? Yeah. Or whom comes to mind for me, right?
Right. And people have been arguing that whom is being phased out for, you know, 50 or 100 years, that people have been predicting the demise of whom. And I do think that it is fading away more, but it's still in use. I mean, editors will still change it if you get it wrong in you know, a scholarly work or, you know, a serious novel. You know, if you're doing dialogue and, you know, it would probably be better not to use whom, even if it's called for, because people don't really talk that way and you want your dialogue to sound natural. So, I mean, that's a good example, too. In fiction, you break the rules of grammar all the time, because when people speak, they break the rules of grammar all the time. And you want your characters to sound real and not like a computer-generated, grammatically perfect, you know, voice. And the rules that are harder to remember, like whom, are the ones that are under more pressure to go away, because the style guides reflect how language is really used. I'm trying to think of, there was an example the AP style book gave a few years ago at the ACES meeting. So the traditional rule was that you shouldn't start a sentence with hopefully, that hopefully only meant in a hopeful manner, you know, so you could say, Squiggly looked at the chocolate, hopefully. and you shouldn't, and if you wanted to say, hopefully it'll rain tomorrow, you should actually say, I hope it will rain tomorrow. So that was this traditional rule that, but editors always had to enforce it because people say, hopefully. And the AP found that their, I think it was this rule, that their writers were just writing hopefully so often that they finally said, look, this is common usage. We're not going to enforce it anymore. It's sort of a, it's not, it's changed. It's not a rule because nobody does it. And so, you know, they were spending so much time, like more of their professional writers were doing it wrong than doing it right. And that's kind of the point at which they say, we're not going to do this anymore. I mean, what they say is we reflect common usage. So that's one way that language changes.
And here's a few of our favorite moments from Jane Friedman.
Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us. You know, to start, I'm just curious if you can give us a little background. In what area of publishing did you begin your career and how did it evolve into your present role?
My very first position was a newspaper copy editor when I was still a college student. And following that, I was in literary journal publishing again on a university level. And following that, I started working at a traditional book publisher based out of Cincinnati, an enthusiast publisher. It was strictly nonfiction during most of the time that I was there.
Was that Writer's Digest?
The corporation that owns Writer's Digest is known as F&W Media. So I started working there as an intern, but not for Writer's Digest. It's a fairly, you know, sizable company with lots of different types of publications. So in fact, I started working in the craft division, and one of the very first books I worked on was How to Paint Animals on Rocks. And I should point out, everyone laughs about that title, which is quite natural, but it was one of the best-selling series in company history.
Of course it was. That's publishing for you.
And then where did you go from there?
After that, I took a detour into university teaching. So I spent a couple years at the University of Cincinnati teaching digital media majors. I was the writing specialist, which makes sense because I did spend most of my time at Writer's Digest while I was at F&W. And then I went back into publishing, worked at another literary journal in Charlottesville, Virginia, the Virginia Quarterly Review. I've stayed a couple years and then went full-time freelance. So I've been freelance now for going on 5 years.
5 years. Congratulations, because it's been very successful. All of my authors read your newsletter and love you and reference you and are constantly saying, did you read this on Jane's blog? And I'm like, yes, I did. I read it. And your newsletter is amazing. And I think such a great resource for writers. So thank you for that. But I also want to ask you about your book and why you wrote a book on the business of being a writer.
There's a conference I've been going to for years now. It's called the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, AWP. It moves around the country and it's attended by probably 10,000 writers, mainly creative writing students, professors, and others in the literary publishing community. So all the literary journals and so on. I've been going to this conference a long time. Like, I first attended in 1997. Yes, 1997. And since 2003, I've been attending uninterrupted. So in any event, every year I go, inevitably, there would be a panel where some writer would say, if only I had known how difficult it was to make a living at writing, especially after going into so much debt to get this degree. So it felt like there was a missing piece here. Business may or may not be taught in writing programs. It really depends on the culture of the program. There weren't any good textbooks or resources that, you know, offered a foundation in books, magazines, online, and how one forms a career out of writing. So that was part of the inspiration.
You know, Jane, I go to the AWP conference every year, and it's probably my favorite writing conference, but I'm one of those MFA students who I'm always amazed that I was taught nothing about publishing or anything other than the craft of writing. And so I think it's really, really necessary. And I think writers tend to be too passive or not engaged in learning about it. So I was wondering, maybe to scare people into learning a little bit about the business of publishing, what are some of the bad career decisions you've heard of because the writer didn't know the business well enough?
There are all sorts of myths surrounding writing and publishing careers. One of them happens to be if you can just get that agent or if you can just land that book deal, then you're set. Now, there are some people who know that is a myth, and it's very unlikely you will be set once that happens. But there's such a taboo around discussing the money involved in book deals, like what the advance is like, what the royalties might be like, the fact that 70 to 80% of traditionally published books don't earn out their advance, that, you know, after you account for the agent percentage and the taxes, you know, you're probably not looking at a full-time living from that book deal. So I think one of the things I try to tell writers right from the start is don't expect to make your living on book sales alone, and certainly not from selling work to literary journals. But I think that becomes pretty clear even when you're still in college.
Yeah. The first check I got from a literary journal came years and years after I'd published in little tiny ones. And I think it was $250, which seemed huge to me.
Well, that's how much I get paid now for articles. So I actually think, you know, it's an interesting thing that this is really such not a lucrative business, and you have to cobble it together in so many ways. So, Jane, every time there's a publishing revolution in history, people see that as both a threat and an opportunity, it seems. And you make the great point on your website that writers have been innovating since the Gutenberg era. So I was wondering if you could talk about an innovation in the history of book publishing that really stands out for you and how that might inform where we are today.
Well, one of the innovations, which is going to sound strange, is the fact that authors ought to be paid for their work. So for at least a couple hundred years, you know, from the time, if you start at Gutenberg, authors didn't get paid because they felt their work was divinely inspired. And so to accept payment for it would be very crass. You don't, you know, get paid for what God has given to you. But eventually, you know, the publishers were making money hand over fist, and authors eventually got cut into that, fortunately. But before that time, before they started getting a cut of sales, and, you know, copyright had to be invented as part of that, writers had patrons. So you were either born of great privilege and you didn't need money in the first place, or you had patrons who helped fund your writing career. And it is kind of like, you know, a Back to the Future sort of phenomenon, where you're seeing that model arise again with platforms like Patreon.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Speaking of publishing innovations, the advent of ebooks and self-publishing have really changed the publishing landscape in the last decade or so. And I know a lot of writers and NaNoWriMo writers grapple with that question of whether to traditionally publish or to self-publish. They're two very different ways of going about it. So I'm curious, what advice would you give authors to help them make that decision?
Well, it's all, of course, dependent on your goals and what your long-term vision is for where your career is going. So, for instance, if you're a romance writer or you want to build a career writing romance novels, then very likely you're looking at something that's more indie-driven. You'll probably be self-publishing. It's not to say that you can't traditionally publish, but, you know, the trend in the market right now is for independent authors. You see independent authors as the really savvy and successful ones. But on the flip side of that, if you're in, say, let's say you're a poet, you know, going to another extreme, it's going to be really hard to establish yourself if you want to get, say, a position at a university as a professor and teach poetry to others without having a traditional publishing track record. Although I have to add the caveat that we now have these Instagram poets, that phenomenon. And so you see that too, where self-publishing has played a role. But, you know, those people, the very successful ones, have jumped from self-pub to traditional because well, there are lots of reasons, but you know, they're making a lot of money doing other things other than writing books at this point, like speaking and appearances and however you make money now as an influencer on Instagram.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cobbling it all together in some way. So I love your quote where you say it's so easy to not read a book. It's hard for self-published authors to get on bookshelves, but it's also increasingly hard for any author to get noticed these days. And the whole idea of building what we call in the industry an author platform is very daunting for most writers. Can you define for our listeners what an author platform is and maybe give a tip or two for how one might go about building one?
I see platform as visibility to your readers. And there are lots of ways that visibility can happen. So if we're looking at just at how publishers and agents think about platform and visibility, they're of course interested in how that benefits book sales. If you want a traditional book deal, then you want a platform that demonstrates you can reach readers of books, people who are willing to buy books. But platform, I see it as a much more kind of organic and wide-reaching thing that can allow you to build a business model for your career where it may not necessarily be selling books. It could be selling services, or it could be speaking and appearances, or it could be something related to Patreon, as we discussed before. So building a platform, at the very core of it, is producing work. That's like step number one. It's always the most important step, because producing more work means you're going to have more people experiencing, obviously, that work, who you are, what you stand for, your brand, your message, however you like to think about it, sharing your story. Now, producing work, I think often writers, especially those in traditional writing programs, tend to think about that very narrowly in terms of work that's printed or work that's purchased in certain channels, but it can be your tweets. It can be the Instagram account where you put your poems. It can be Wattpad. It can be your blog. So I think one of the reasons I tend to be on the more optimistic side of the changes that are happening is that platform can now be built in so many ways, and you can decide for yourself, okay, what are my strengths and how do I want to get my message out there that's going to reflect, that's going to be sustainable and best reflect my story and my strengths.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Right Minded. I hope the summertime is giving you more time so that you can go back and either re-listen to past Right Minded episodes or catch up by listening to more and getting ready to write this year and during NaNoWriMo specifically, which is coming up soon. So download Right Minded on your Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to get your podcasts. And please help us out by rating us or giving us a review. It really helps people find us. And we will see you next week. Thank you.